Scotland Tri-Series, Women's T20 qualifying and the Euro T20 Slam in the bin. All that and more around the world and on 91.3 Sport FM. Welcome to the Emerging Cricket Podcast. Red Gazelle once again leading us into another show. Welcome to the Emerging Cricket Podcast and thank you for tuning in again. Back again at your favourite podcast spot and at the home of sport in Perth, 91.3 FM. I'm Daniel Beswick and I'm joined by the two regulars tonight. First to Tim Cutler. Tim, how are you?
Not too bad at all. About to move house over the weekend, which will be fun. I think it's up there for everyone's funnest thing to do. So looking forward to packing some boxes, but otherwise I'm great. How are you, sir?
Tim, I'm well, thank you. And yes, as someone who's moved house recently, it's not an enjoyable task. So I do not envy you in the slightest. Our other usual suspect in the Emerging Cricket Podcast is, of course, the man known on Twitter by many as Copernicus Cricket, Nick Skinner. Nick, how's things?
Oh, you know, working two jobs to support our Emerging Cricket family.
How so? How's that work?
Are we going? We're going to Bermuda for cup match next year. It is on the bucket list.
Oh,
it's
sure
definitely
hope
on mine
so.
And it's probably on yours as well. Glad you could be here, Nick.
Glad I could be here, yes.
And for everyone not aware, this is being recorded at midnight after Nick has returned home after working two shifts. So, yes, that's why he's excited.
Let us know where you are enjoying the podcast with the hashtag ECPod. Let's jump straight into the first topic for this week, and it's a big one, of course. The Euro T20 Slam will not be played this year. If you haven't read our story on our website, the cancellation was down to a few reasons, but the final nail in the coffin was when the event owners refused to inject the additional funds required to run it. It was already behind in its planning and logistics. There were no broadcast arrangements and tickets were not yet on sale to the public. Boys, what a kerfuffle this is. Plenty to talk about, but Tim, I'll open it up to you first. We heard rumours for a while that things weren't looking good with the Euro T20 Slam. It's been a bit of a mess from start to finish, hasn't it?
Well, where to start on this, really? You know, last week, we were lucky enough to speak with two guys that just landed back from Canada and had their own issues, and there are still issues around getting payment or complete payment or reimbursement for those who paid for fares and whatnot to get there in the first place. But yeah, like you say, we had heard a few whispers and we'd hoped that organisers were able to get things all in a row, but there were a lot of noises from a lot of places, including those who were working on the event or hoping to, hearing stories that budgets were being cut after arrangements had been made and there were a lot of issues and emergency meetings. Apparently, the emergency meetings had started or at least been prompted after the Global T20 player strike that almost disrupted all. It did disrupt one of the games and had it starting later. But yeah, it looks like they got together and for reasons, as you stated earlier on, that we're not going to go ahead with it in 2019 and going to look forward to 2020. Since read another piece that looked like they spoke to one of the representatives directly who said that only three of the six franchises had been sold and they were at a ticket price at $4 million. So it just shows the kind of overheads we're looking at here to run the event in three different cities with over 50 overseas players and then the same number again of local players.
Yeah, it's an expensive venture running a T20 tournament ultimately. And yeah, I remember when we were talking about it as it was sort of being announced and all the news was coming out about it. And yeah, this nagging question that I've had the whole time, and this goes for the GT20 as well in Canada, you know, where are they looking to make their money? What's their plan for turning a profit? And ultimately, it seems like they didn't really have one. Because it's just, yeah, the organization, as you said, Bez, has been a mess and with people not being paid and players have decided to play in Europe in this tournament, in their local tournament, instead of looking for contracts elsewhere or working other jobs or, you know, so it's really disrupted a lot of plans and it's just completely unprofessional, really, to be honest, at this level of the game, to be canceling it at the last minute. It's just not good enough. And, you know, you've got the situation where you have players were drafted, but then not given contracts. Or I was talking to Jared Kimber about the whole Schmozzle, and he says, you know, he got a contract, but nobody from the league ever bothered ringing him up to say it was cancelled. So he just sort of saw it on the news, or you know. So it's those sorts of things that make you think it's just not very well organised at all. And
we're hearing that one of the reasons the tickets hadn't gone on sale yet was that the organisers had failed to get permission to use Malahide in Ireland, where they were planning to host the Irish leg of the tournament. That they'd failed to get permission to use the ground from the relevant authorities, which, you know, that's the sort of organisational basics that you'd think they would have got pinned down early on. But, you know, so it's just been very badly organised the whole way through, I think, and it's just all fallen down in the end.
And, you know, when you are dealing with a league like this, and as I said, it's expensive to run a cricket tournament. You need to have a very good plan of where you're going with this. And it just seems like a bit of a headless chickens running around sort of situation from the sounds of everything. Did they employ anyone who knew what they were doing? I don't know.
Yeah, well, a lot of my points echo what you guys have just said. But I think ultimately the biggest losers in all of this, and it's completely out of their hands, is the players, because ultimately this is how they put money on the table for their families, is by playing cricket and being paid to play professional cricket. And I think people forget that so easily because they, for some reason, just don't seem to think that, you know, professional cricketers are people earning a paycheck from week to week, just like us. They're the biggest victims in all this, and it's totally out of their control. And they're the ones who are being promised so much and yeah, as you said, Nick, foregoing playing in the CPL, for instance, to play in a tournament in Europe in these three countries, and ultimately having it fall down around them, and it's, you know, a several weeks that they don't get paid to play cricket, and it severely affects all of them. And players are the most important part of any professional sport. It's the product. It's what people pay to watch. It's the most important thing. If you're organizing a league like this, the players have to be almost paramount in how you deal with a lot of things going forward. You need to do a lot of other things to set up everything and get it going. But you've got to make sure that those people, the players, are the ones accommodated for and covered first, because it is ultimately them who lose out the most in all of this. It was cancelled so late that people who were booking travel to watch this event paid out of their own pocket to watch this tournament. They weren't given enough notice to turn it around, and they lost, you know, bucket loads of money. The organisers of the tournament had very little interest in building the game in Europe and were more concerned about the personal and financial gain coming from a market outside of Europe. I understand, you know, they need to earn their money as well, but it doesn't look like they had the right motives for doing this. Their social media campaign was a disaster, to the point where they were still promoting the competition a day before they binned it on social media, with all the Dean Jones gifts and the alleged signing of Ross Taylor at the very end there. And then a day later, they just led everybody on and then just ended up at the 11th hour cancelling the tournament. And we knew for ages, we had people in and around the traps who told us, you know, there's a very good chance this thing doesn't run. And that was a week before we got confirmation of it. And now they're teasing us with the 2020 competition. And we're all sitting here going, yeah, you can say whatever you want to say, trying to promote next year's competition, but we want to see it materialize. It's just, there were so many logistical hurdles that this tournament needed to overcome. And unfortunately, yeah, it got nowhere close to reaching the finishing tape. And we only need to look back a few weeks ago and see how to run a competition in mainland Europe. And that was through the European Cricket League. Admittedly, it was a different format and the logistics were different, but Daniel Weston and his team organized a fantastic tournament. And they obviously gave themselves plenty of time to do it in, but it was a fantastically run tournament and was something that, you know, a lot of people should be taking pages out of in terms of creating a tournament that has some sort of success and exposure for the people playing in the tournament. Once again, the players are the most important commodity in all this. You know, half of them are sitting at home doing nothing at the moment, being like, well, we could have been in the Caribbean. We could be playing some more cricket. Luckily for a few guys around, they're playing international cricket at the moment, the Scots especially, and the Netherlands A are playing some cricket at the moment. But Scotland are going to hastily organise some T20 cricket before their global qualifier coming up. It's so difficult for them because they'd earmarked and had these games in the calendar and they've just been taken away. I'd love to sit here and sort of praise and commend people who organise events like this, because it really could have been something fantastic, especially for the three countries that it was being based in. We would love to sit here and commend them for what they've done. And, you know, heck, I would have loved to have been involved in this competition, but you can't give these false promises and run the campaigns that you run and just deliver nothing in the end. And a story only came out this week that a third of professional cricketers have experienced pay problems. That's unacceptable. These people work just like everyone else. The difference is they work by playing cricket. It's as simple as that.
Decent rant there, Bez, before we go on. That was almost up there with Delhi Capitals.
Where's
please play Sandeep Lamichani.
Wake up.
Just picking up some of your points that you fulminated, you talk about, well, they were still tweeting up until 5 hours or 4 hours, I think, before they actually made the call. So that really does speak to sort of left hand, right hand. And I guess when these high level talks are going on, generally probably your social media person isn't going to be told that this is happening. But likewise, you think you might just give them a nudge to say, just sit back a little bit on those.
Just tone it down a little bit. Yeah.
I guess in one way it says, you know, where's left hand, right hand, but also how confident they maybe were up until the last night. As you mentioned, you know, dropping all those Euro T20 GIFs that were then used the next day, basically about the news, you know, there's, again, a bit of forethought missing there. And you talk about the players, and I'm with you there, but it's not just the players we're talking about here. You touched on the fans that had bought tickets, and we've seen a lot of tweets and Facebook messages about that, but it's also all the staff around it as well. There's the staff,
coaches,
officials, but there's also scores of broadcast people being involved, everyone putting up grandstands and the ticket sales and everyone that had a contract agreed with to be part of this event, who had all booked away 3 weekends over August and September, who are now, well, as far as we're aware, not going to be receiving a dime, you know, including the local players hadn't signed contracts as far as we're aware. And also those overseas players who may have contracts or not, we're not 100% sure there. But either way, it's not just those players. You're right, that's essential, and player welfare should be at the centre of everything that we do in cricket. But when you start listing down the people that have been left in the lurch here, it really is, well, it's beyond a head scratcher. It is really disappointing. And you think, well, if people are going to be talking about running T20 events in associate countries over the next year or so, they're going to look back and hark back to the stories about Canada and players not being paid, and whether they all get paid in time or not, there's still going to be a lingering dissatisfaction there. And then when the Euro T20 Slam, after all of its launch and everything, was then pulled 2 weeks before, it's like, geez, to make these calls with the amount of money that's been put in, you know, is there a future in running these big events? And we saw the UAE T20X, all too similar to this now, where they really shot for the stars, and that the prices they're paying for their overseas players. Remember, Owen Morgan was down to get paid, I think, about $350,000, if I'm not incorrect. And they weren't able to sell the franchises in a very similar situation here. They'd sold some of the franchises, didn't have a lot of sponsor interest, and they had to pull it only weeks before the event was supposed to run. And of course, not long after that, the CEO of Emirates Cricket moved on as well. So there's a bad line of stories here. And as we said in the article, that had been a bad 2 weeks. You know, there was the GT20 news, the Hong Kong Sixers are being cancelled, and the T20 Blitz was under threat, and this can happen. So, dearie me. And in the past, we've had the stories like the Afro T20 stopping midway, and of course, that unapproved comedy of match fixing the Ajman All-Stars that was ended up being investigated by the ICC. You know, that alongside the questions and the points made by FIKA about player payments, it's definitely time to be taking a second look at how we do this, just for the game's sake, and as you said, for all the players and everyone else involved who's in the middle of it.
Yeah, it's almost a bit embarrassing, really. I mean, Dan Weston is a very smart bloke, but he's not a professional tournament organiser. So the fact that he, as a hobby, has just decided to run a cricket tournament and broadcast it and pay everyone and you know, everything's run smoothly, and these so-called professionals couldn't get a tournament off the ground, says a lot to me. And you're right, it was a different format, Bez, but if one bloke in Germany can do it, I think a whole group of people can do it too. I think back to Anshi talking about the situation in Canada, you know, Anshman Rath from Hong Kong, and saying, ultimately, we're professionals, we're providing a service. I'm thinking, Tim, you know, if you don't pay the removalists, are they going to carry your stuff out of your house? No, of course not. Like, it's just, it doesn't make any sense to me whatsoever that they can just think, we don't need to worry about this payment stuff. Of course you need to worry about it. It's just a shambles, really. And yeah, touching on your point there, Tim, about the other tournaments, I guess, that have sort of fallen by the wayside, it's disappointing and looks bad for associate cricket, you know, and we sort of talked about this a bit last week. The associates are sort of in the situation where everything needs to go well for them, or every time they play, they need to be putting in a quote-unquote competitive performance, or every time there's a tournament, it needs to run smoothly, because there's a lot of suspicion around associate cricket. And then if this was a full member competition that's gone belly up, you know, it wouldn't be the end of the world for them. But for an associate tournament, it's always going to have this sort of stigma, I guess, and until people learn to trust associate cricket. And so I think, yeah, it's going to probably do a lot of damage to the associate game and, you know, anyone else trying to start something like this. Or even if they do get to 2020 and they're a bit more organized this time, once bitten, twice shy, I guess, is the saying. And a lot of people who saw how this fell apart are going to be very wary of getting involved next time.
Yeah, and let's not make out that it's an only an associate problem as well. I think everything you just said there is spot on about from what Antti said and how you expanded and how associate cricket is under that spotlight. But we've had, you know, issues with the Bangladesh Premier League in the past, both with player payments and also NOCs not being issued and whatnot. But when you've got the bank balances of a lot of these full members that are able to absorb potential losses or TV rights money not coming in time, or indeed franchises not being sold, that's one thing. But the problems, as we've described, them are still there. But when these hero events, if we refer to them that way, are set up, well, it's the next big thing, shall we say, for associate members, or where we've got Ireland involved as well, it's just so much more to lose. And I guess it goes back to us talking from the early days about local engagement and getting more and more people involved rather than just seeming to be relying on that overseas market, as we'd mentioned. But well, as you said, you know, when it comes around 2020, it's going to be very interesting to see whether they take a similar tack with the same number of teams and overseas players and fee scales, shall we say, for those players also with the locals, or whether they're going to be a little bit more conservative and maybe look at only playing in one or two cities to try and keep costs down. But, you know, it's definitely once bitten here, and we just hope that for the sakes of franchise cricket in Europe, it's not twice shy.
Just to pick up from what you've said, Tim, it was running through my head as well, is that especially at this level of the international game where you have Scotland and the Netherlands, two associate members, and Ireland being a recent full member, I just think that whoever it is organising pay packets for players doesn't realise that these guys, first of all, they aren't earning as much money as they probably should. But the second point is that they probably don't have savings big enough to, as you say, absorb potential non-payments. They're toying with these players, and as Kyle said last week, Kyle Kurtzer, in the chat that we had, if you haven't listened to it already, make sure you do it after you listen to this one. The point that Kyle made was that the last thing that he wants to think about while playing a game of cricket is if he's going to be paid or not. And the only thing that they want to be worried about on any given day that they play is what they have to do to win a game of cricket. They don't want to worry about every single thing under the sun outside of cricket that, to me, yeah, it's just ridiculous. You can't just keep toying with the players like this in the hope that things work out. You need to be able to say up front, we can provide this service that is a necessity when you employ someone, is to actually be able to pay them. So hopefully, you know, if we do see a tournament next year, they do iron things out. Looking back at the draft and the launch of the tournament, the writing was on the wall a little bit with a few things that were said and done.
Well, they did say they were bringing it a year forward,
didn't they? No, they said that they were taking putting a bit of pressure on themselves by running it in the first year.
Yeah. Well, the comment at the end by the MC, I can't remember a name, so excuse me for that, but said something along the lines of, and hopefully this runs so well, it will make us very, very rich. You know, you don't have to be an expert to work out that at this level of cricket, there's no such thing as a free lunch. So, yeah, look, hopefully things are ironed out and people sort out their issues, and we can say next year that there will be a tournament that benefits the game in Europe. But yeah, I'll believe it when I see it, to be perfectly honest.
Well, Bez, we've talked about locking money away in accounts in escrow before these events happen. What other changes could we make? What could we suggest while we're here talking about it?
It's a fair question to ask, because, you know, while we are sitting here criticizing, it'd be a little bit unfair if we didn't come up with a solution. Again, I'm no expert in running a T20 franchise competition, but I would imagine that securing broadcast rights would have to be a pretty significant priority, given that that's where a lot of your revenue is going to come from. From there, it's about, once you do secure those broadcast deals, I think it would be a lot easier for people to sell the franchises to other people, because they know that they're going to get the exposure in however many countries that the games are being broadcast. I could be quite naive in all this. I'm certainly no expert in it, but I feel like that's probably what you need to secure first before you then say, okay, well, how much money can we commit to the playing group for organizing a tournament like this? Once you do have that money to spend, that's when the players become a huge priority, because, okay, here's your budget. We're going to promise you to pay X to play in a 2-3 week tournament. And ultimately, you guys are the entertainment. You guys are the product. Therefore, we, you know, we obviously want some high quality cricket. And yeah, we believe that you guys are the players to do it. The idea was good. I think things were done a little bit backwards and committing to icon players when franchises haven't been sold and things like that. I think you've got to put together the pieces behind the scenes before you go forward and say, look, how much money can we commit to international cricketers? But then once you do have it all set up, the cricketers become the top priority in those that you are accommodating for because they're ultimately the most important part of your product.
Yeah, it all becomes a bit chicken and egg-ish, doesn't it? Because you think about securing the broadcast.
Yeah,
but how do you secure the broadcast without the players? Yeah, and look, I've been there, done it. I know these questions.
You would be the perfect person to ask this question too. So I kind of flip it towards you, Tim. How did you go about it in the Blitz? What was your modus operandi?
The tournament formerly known as the Blitz.
Yes.
Well, the thing was that we started smaller, and that's where I sort of look at it. I'm not trying to say that they should have been like the Blitz, but I guess if the things were going to go wrong, those 2 years that I was involved, that it was manageable. That the first year it was only streamed with four or five cameras. That was that first year that Michael Clarke was there. And then year two, we had a proper stream with, I think, seven or eight cameras. It didn't go on TV, but it was a pretty good quality. You can still jump on YouTube and have a look at them. But, you know, having the cost base a lot lower and not overcommitting ourselves and only having 5 days of play meant that we were pretty aware of what our costs were going to be around what we needed to do ticket-wise, sponsor-wise. And we'd also found ourselves five great franchise owners as well, which the tournament wouldn't have run without them, really. And I guess that's the difference there as well. That was what we did. We sold the franchises on the premise of wanting to run the event, and we were able to sell them. Therefore, we ran the event as opposed to committing to running the event by hook or by crook. And whether we had franchises or not, you know, we've pondered previously as to whether that T20 pie, whether that's getting bigger, whether more and more people are trying to get a slice of the same size, or whether pie's growing either way. And that's, I think that's a question still to be thought about now, whether have we reached a saturation point for the value of these leagues? You know, it'll be interesting to see what happens with TV rights now that the Murdoch-controlled conglomerate of Fox, Star and Sky have been broken up, with, you know, Star now being owned by Disney, Sky now coming under the Comcast brand, and Fox still being Australia, whether there's still going to be more interest out there for global leagues. But, you know, ultimately that's where the money's coming from. That's what pays for global cricket is the media rights, and that's what pays for T20 cricket as well. You know, ticket sales and sponsorship are there to bulk it up. But, you know, IPL, 5 years, $2.5 billion, you know, that's where the cash is coming from.
Going back to what maybe they should be looking to do to ensure that the event happens, it seems like it's one of those situations where their focus seemed muddled. They didn't really have a clear vision of what they were actually trying to achieve. And, you know, going back to Dan Weston and his team, and they had a very clear vision of what they were doing and they executed it effectively. But the reason they were able to execute it so well is because they knew what they were doing. Whereas it just sort of seems like Bombay Sports Group, are they trying to run a development league that's going to boost cricket on the continent and, you know, maybe towards the back end of that 10-year contract start paying dividends? And, you know, they made some noises along those lines in the launch. Or are they looking for a quick buck, as they sort of implied with their hopefully this will make us all very rich? And looking at associate cricket, I mean, would that you could just make a quick buck out of associate cricket. Potentially, I wouldn't be working two jobs to support a podcast. Yeah, it just seems a bit strange that these guys come in cowboy sort of operators, like they think they're going to be able to just pick up some profits straight away. And that's just not... I just think they've completely misread the state of the game in Europe, and potentially they weren't, as you sort of alluded to there, Bez, yeah, they weren't really that interested in actually growing the game, which is, that's where you need to be looking to make some money, is to actually grow that market there rather than just keep trying to throw everything at the overseas Indian market for the TV. And getting back to, I guess, the administration side of things, did they do their due diligence in terms of the franchises? And, you know, if you're not selling them, what's going wrong?
Well, yeah, well, firstly, the DD would have been done heavily from the members in the ICC before the league started. I know that would have gone through the ringer, well, likewise before Canada got that approved too. So is that the question? Is that done as thoroughly? But knowing how hard that team works within the ICC of making sure things are lined up, and perhaps there's more to it. But I think, just as you were talking, Nick, I was just thinking about what was the plan? You know, what would we have done differently? What could have been done differently? You know, to think about the fact that we were 2 weeks out from an event, tickets weren't for sale. You know, tickets tickets should have been for sale 6 months out. Yeah, sorry to use Hong Kong as another example. I know they only announced it 4 months, but it should have been on as soon as possible. You know, the Hong Kong Sevens tickets go on sale basically as soon as a couple of months after the Sevens finish. You know, they're already lining it up. That's income source coming in and something that they can rely on to keep the event going. And that's a 40,000 seat stadium sold out for 3 days. But the number of tickets they were hoping to sell for this event, you know, was a key part, a key income line as well. You know, not as much as what they would have been hoping to get from TV rights or sponsors or franchises. But I think it really did show that as well intentions as they were, and by no stretch are we intimating anything differently from all reports, the team behind it were passionate as anyone about trying to get the event up and running. But it really just got the feeling, we got the feeling looking at it, they're just bitten off so much more than they could chew. The fact that late in the day, they employed a local social media guy up in Ireland, but the fact that tickets hadn't been on sale and people didn't know what was going to be happening, the fact that people had booked travel to go there, you could say, well, perhaps that was a little bit misguided. But for all intents and purposes, this event was going to be on, you know, and you can only wait so long until you book travel. But the fact that the tickets hadn't been put on sale, and we've talked about that lack of real local engagement, I think just shows that perhaps that strategy and goal and mission was not clear and in complete contrast to what we saw at the ECL. You know, and the quality of the cricket wasn't what you're used to watching with that quality of broadcast, but it did what it said on the can, didn't it? He ran a T10 league, got all the games in, had all fees paid, players happy, people raving about it. One of the players in the president's box from Romania during the Ashes, and everybody talking about how great it was, despite, you could say, its failings to the quality of cricket, perhaps not what people were expecting to see. So you talk about being clear in your goal, and whether you agree with Dan Weston's vision or not, the guy has delivered what he said he was going to.
Yeah, and just going back to what you said about the tickets, you can always create the fixtures, put them there, and let people in their own right mind purchase the tickets well before. If the tournament is cancelled for whatever reason, refund the tickets. It's not difficult. These are things that they had control of that they failed to do successfully, and it was just another, you know, card in what was a collapsing house of cards. It was a mess.
No, absolutely. And as simple as it sounds, you can pick your zones. You can have half of the Netherlands being Rhinos and the other half being the Knights. You know, I don't think it's that hard and that much harder to imagine how it could be done. And hopefully, maybe my last point, and I've talked about it a lot, these are the things that the three countries are going to be able to do with, 9 or 10 months runway. They're talking about trying to run it in June. You know, we don't have a World Cup or 50-over World Cup going for 7 weeks in the middle of the year to block it out. So whilst we've got the Women's T20 World Cup in February, March, and the men's in October, you know, there's a big gap in the northern summer. So hopefully they're able to find a place, and hopefully they can start putting the plans down to have something that really is a hero T20 franchise event for Europe.
Yeah, and as they sort of pick through the wreckage, I think I would hope that they would refocus and, yeah, sort of as you allude to there, Tim, make it more about the community engagement rather than the big flashy league, because, yeah, the big flashy league didn't work out. So maybe you should try the community engagement angle, which is basically that's what Dan Weston's trying to do and seems to be working out all right for him so far.
Well, or do both. You know, it doesn't have to be either or. You know, you should be hitting them wherever you can. I think it could be both. And I know you weren't saying only do one. I'm just trying to reiterate the point, is it doesn't have to be one or the other. You know, you can have your icon players that will draw in your already captive cricket crowd and potentially your cricket tourists and then your subcontinent fans that are going to follow the likes of a Yuvraj wherever he goes. You can still do that, but you can also try and drum up some local interest by doing those simple things that we talked about.
Things like names that actually reflect the place that they're based in.
That was another warning sign, wasn't it? That the attention and the research that was done was either non-existent or lackluster. Well,
and you know what? For all of the criticisms and you could say the failure of trying to get up this year, there's a real opportunity to start fresh in 2020. And that could mean, we can only hope, you know, wipe the slate clean and even look at, as suggestions were made, have your team naming competition, you know, get your local engagement, you know, and, you know, these are simple things. You'd really get some goodwill and to have kids from countries that aren't necessarily, wouldn't have cricket in the mainstream. You know, this is what you want to see, that the players out there handing over the certificates, congratulating the kids or whoever designed these things with free tickets and their school coming to the game. You know, all this stuff should be part and parcel of the outreach, and even better to have names that you hear and you think, well, that's a Dutch team, or that's an Irish team, or that is indeed a Scottish team.
The silver lining in all of this is that, okay, yeah, people make mistakes, people organising the tournament have made mistakes, but there's an opportunity for people to pick up and learn from it and provide a fantastic product for the fans, the players, and ultimately everyone involved in cricket and associate cricket, at least for two out of the three countries. And there is an opportunity for something to be done, because the idea is good. The idea is, it would be beneficial to all three countries involved if it is done correctly. The main issue is being able to find the team who can provide a viable competition and a viable product that is beneficial for everyone involved. Let's move on to the Spain-Finland T20 International Series that has been played in Kerava in Finland. It was Spain who came from behind to win the series 2-1. I'll just run through the results quickly before we have a quick discussion on the matter. Finland posted 185 in the first game to win by 82 runs, though in the second and third matches, Spain were quite comfortable, chasing down targets of 136 and 159 by 6 and 4 wickets respectively. The first successful chase with 6 balls to spare, and the second just 2 balls in hand, but seemingly comfortable given that they had quite a few wickets in hand. Nick, I'll talk to you first on this. Looking at the stream, it was quite a professional looking broadcast, given that, you know, these are two international sides that aren't exactly renowned for their cricket, certainly, but a good series to follow. And again, the coverage was quite good. But Spain just a little bit too strong to come back to win the series 2-1.
Yeah, pretty exciting end there, you know, last over result deciding the series. Yeah, good little series. And this is another one of those things, we sort of talk about this a bit in previous podcasts, but just these, you know, local rivals organizing sort of regional kind of tournaments in, you know, within relatively close flying distance of each other. And hopefully we see more of these in the future. And good job by Finland, actually, you know, having commentary and yeah, good looking stream. And I have to say, as a languages nerd, I think hearing Finnish cricket commentary is that's not something I was ever expecting, but it was great to hear nonetheless.
Yeah, it was fascinating listening to Finnish cricket commentary, and as you said, Nick, it's something that I didn't expect to hear probably ever. There were a couple of oddities that I did notice in reading the scorecards and keeping up with the games. One individual that stood out for me was Ravi Panchal. With both ball and bat, actually, just watching a little bit and then obviously seeing the scores, he looked a cut above. Quite an interesting story, actually, just doing some research before we recorded. He was born in Birmingham. He's 25 now, and he's also played for Spain at under-19s and under-17s level. So he's been in the setup for quite a while. Again, just another product of obviously moving in his youth, but still continuing to play cricket in a not-so-renowned cricketing country, which is a great story in itself. And yeah, providing the goods for Spain, for his country. I did notice one scorecard oddity in the first game of the series. Spain actually had 2 Diamond Ducks in their innings.
Is that a record?
I don't think I've ever seen that before. But Paul Hennessy, who opened the batting for Spain, had a Diamond Duck. And then Zulkarnain Haider was also run out without facing a ball. I've never seen 2 Diamond Ducks in the same innings, but it's just what cricket throws up, is these curiosities every once in a while that are just interesting to read. But again, I was a huge fan of watching a little bit. Admittedly, I didn't watch too much of the stream, but keeping up with the scores.
Nice looking field too up in Finland.
Yeah, and it's just good competitive cricket for both of these countries, you know, to be able to organise a bilateral series between, you know, 2 countries in Europe. Full credit to everyone involved. I think it's great, and hopefully we see more of these series played out. We saw Hungary and the Czech Republic. They weren't recognised as T20 internationals, but it's starting to happen more and more. There's countries around who are playing their neighbours in international bilateral cricket, which is good to see, and hopefully it builds, you know, competition through that way as well.
Yeah, and don't forget we're going to have sub-regional qualifiers coming up pretty damn soon for the 2021 T20 World Cup. You know, whilst we're talking about the road to Australia for 2020, I think the ICC is already starting to get things in line for the qualifying events across all five regions. So it's probably just as well these teams are playing as much T20 cricket as they can. Finland and Spain both having been involved in the sub-regionals last year, leading to the exciting Europe qualifier that came down to the last ball as to whether Jersey or Germany qualified. This is great. I guess this is what T20i status for all was meant to achieve, in getting these teams playing more and more cricket and being in the record books. So with two diamond ducks, hopefully we won't get any statisticians calling upon the ICC to have these records stricken from the books. And of course, we've just seen JP Kurtzer score 100 off, oh geez, how many?
It was 43 balls.
Off 43 balls in his first ever T20 international against Botswana. So hopefully that's gone past certain Twitterati.
The 2020 World Cup in 2020, people are going to love that as it rolls off the tongue.
Not in England, they're not. They've got the 100 in 2020.
And speaking of the T20 World Cups in 2020, we have both the men's and the women's, and teams that were gearing up for the global qualifier in Europe played in the quadrangular series in the Netherlands last week. We did go through the winner being Thailand of that series, but we didn't really have a chance to run through some key performers and the table for that. Of course, Thailand do now have a world record in international cricket, which is fantastic to say. They've won 17 T20 internationals on the trot. That was, of course, until they were knocked off by Scotland in one of their matches in this quadrangular series. Thailand did hold on to win the tournament with 5 wins from 6 matches and 10 points. Now, the other three teams, Scotland, 4 wins from 6 matches, Ireland with 2 wins, and the Netherlands going home empty-handed. It was a great lead-up for all these teams heading into the global qualifier in Scotland coming up soon. Nick, I'll start with you. Just thinking about this Thai team, they actually have quite a decent run and a very clear path to actually qualifying for the World Cup proper. They obviously have to do the job when it gets to the qualifier, but there is a very good chance that they can turn a few heads and qualify for the tournament.
Yeah, wouldn't that be a great story, having Thailand in the Australian-hosted T20 World Cup? You know, similar region and a lot of ties, so to speak, in other areas between the two countries. And yeah, as we've said before, you know, it's one of these exciting areas of potential growth for the game, and as cricket, yeah, looks to expand beyond its sort of Commonwealth and subcontinent traditional strongholds, I think East Asia is a logical fit for it. So great to see Thailand continuing to do well. Looking at the results, 4 out of the top 5 bowlers in this tournament were Thai, and that's a similar story to back a few months ago when they blitzed their way through the Asian sub-regionals, you know, where they had, I think it was 3 of the top 4 bowlers were Thai. And yeah, same story. Their bowlers really dominated. And it's been good to see a few different names stepping up. And, you know, we saw Narumol Chaiwai last time doing the business with the bat. But this time we've had Natakan Chantam, which rolls off the tongue very nicely, also contributing. And yeah, so it's good to see that they've got a lot of depth in their side. You know, they've got bowlers coming around everywhere and a few different batters coming through as well. So I think they're going to be a real threat in the qualifiers. And just looking at that tournament, you know, they're in the same group as Ireland and the Netherlands, who they beat comfortably in this quadrangular tournament, as well as Namibia, who are a strong side, but I don't think they're too much far, you know, I don't think they're too far ahead of Thailand. And then going through, who are they going to place for the spot in the 2020 World Cup? There's Bangladesh or Papua New Guinea or Scotland, who are probably realistic chances of making it through the other group. And yeah, as you say, I think Thailand, very strong chance of qualifying if they play their cards right in the tournament.
Yeah, just to clarify those listening now, that the two groups for that global qualifier, Group A is Bangladesh, Papua New Guinea, Scotland, the United States. Group B is Ireland, Namibia, Netherlands, Thailand. Now, of course, Namibia only qualified for this portion of the tournament as Zimbabwe have had to drop out. If Thailand finish first in Group B, they play second in Group A. And if they win that match, they do qualify, because then, of course, the two top teams play in the final and they're the two teams that ultimately qualify for the T20 World Cup. And yeah, as you said, Nick, I was kind of doing the same equations in my head. Between Bangladesh and I'd say maybe Scotland are probably going to finish first and second. They've already beaten Scotland. And Bangladesh, we're not too sure how they're going to go. They played in the T20 World Cup in the West Indies. So we haven't really got too much of a gauge of how well they're playing recently because I believe they automatically qualified for this event by participating in the last World Cup. So they could be a little bit underdone coming into this qualifier, and it may depend on how much cricket they actually play leading up to this one. You mentioned the bowlers for Thailand in this particular quadrangular series, and just looking at the batters that also made bulk runs. The two top batsmen for Thailand was Natakan Chantham, as you mentioned, and also Nanapat Koncharongkai, who also made quite a few runs and I believe also keeps with them or can keep. So plenty of versatility, and the way the Thais are going to win games is, yeah, the runs will be for show, but I think the bowling will be for the dough. I think they'll bowl a lot of teams out. They seem to be a quality side with the ball and in the field. But yeah, it does open up what will be a fantastic global women's qualifier, because you look at Ireland as a team who participated in the last Women's World Cup, and they're by no means a guaranteed thing to go through in their group in the global qualifier now with so much talent around, and the parity actually being quite even amongst the women's teams at this level. So that'll be a really interesting tournament.
Absolutely. I mean, talk about the pressure in associate cricket. And she put it so well last week in describing it, well, at least from a non-regular associate player from one of the Namibians who played a lot of first-class cricket in South Africa before moving to NAM, saying that he couldn't believe how much pressure was piled on associate cricketers in these events. And we're going to see that, I think, with these two teams especially. But this will, you know, Thailand's biggest ever cricket event, this men or women playing for that country. You know, I just think of, it's going to be great for us to see how this team performs under that type of pressure. We've seen them beat Sri Lanka in the Asia Cup, but again, it wasn't for a spot in something as big as a World Cup. So I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, and these are the sort of stories that can really inspire the home fans to start paying attention, you know, getting through qualifiers. And, you know, let's not forget Thailand's football team is, let's just put it kindly and say it's not the best in the world. So I think there's a lot of opportunity for cricket to step into that gap where their women's team certainly is challenging for a spot in the top 10. And that's, you know, that's a pretty major achievement, even in women's cricket. And so I think the momentum they can gain, you know, if they do keep up this form, would be a great story. And yeah, I think it'll just help them go from strength to strength.
And remembering as well, the women's T20 World Cup event doesn't have a first round like what the men's does. They've got two groups of five, so that's a guaranteed four matches against full member opposition. So whichever teams are able to get through, and of course from this point of view, we hope they're both associate nations and great for cricket, but whoever gets through will have four great matches rather than what we see with the men's with only three. And as we saw in India being somewhat before the tournament, at least the rest of the world starts proper when they're also showing warm-up games played by other nations that they have better primetime spots. So, yeah, look, what can we say? I think the Thai team is one of the podcast favourite cricket teams, and I think we're going to be cheering hard for them, aren't we?
Yeah, and it's just a result of a great growth of cricket in the area. We've seen Japan qualify for the under-19 men or boys or men's Cricket World Cup.
Boys, two men.
Yeah, love a bit of 90s R&B, do you, Nick?
So you can use pop culture references from 90s R&B, but we say a Simpsons joke and it goes all silent at your end.
What can I say? I'm a complicated man.
We have shared digs with you in Namibia. We can agree with that statement.
Oh, gee. I could go further. I shared a bunk bed with the man.
Well, there was a pair of bunks and one was on the top and one was on the bottom.
Correct. Well, you do share, well...
It's the same entity, isn't it? It's the same unit.
Yeah. It's one thing split in...
Yeah, I guess that's right, isn't it? It's like a pair of trousers, really, isn't it? You can't have one without the other. Can you have a bunk bed if there's no other bed? You know, is it a bunk?
Well, no, then it's just a bed, right?
You know, these questions and more on the Emerging Cricket Podcast.
Oh, we are an educational podcast.
Obviously.
Yeah, as I was saying, you know, Thailand are just another product of what's been an explosive growth of cricket in Asia and other parts of the emerging cricket world. Thailand now, and of course, Japan in the under-19s Cricket World Cup qualifying for that. And then if you move to Africa, you can talk about Nigeria qualifying for the under-19 Men's World Cup as well. So some great stories coming out. And yeah, we're keen to see where this global qualifier will go. Just to run through the dates for that tournament, because a lot of you will be watching that with keen interest. It's the 31st of August to the 7th of September. So not too far away from that. And of course, Scotland hosting that tournament as well. Yeah, eight teams vying for two World Cup spots for next year's T20 World Cup in Australia. And that will be hugely exciting. Let's move on to the start of the ICC Men's Cricket World Cup League 2 tournament. Of course, it's the start of qualification for the 2023 Cricket World Cup in India, the Tri-Series in Scotland by between, of course, host Scotland, Oman and Papua New Guinea. Scotland and Oman shared the spoils in this one, winning three matches each and losing one to each other, in fact, with PNG unfortunately not opening their account for the tournament. Of course, played in Scotland, the pitches did look a little bit slower than we might have perhaps thought they would be at the Manorfield Ground in Aberdeen. But you have to say Scotland and Oman doing the early running.
Yeah, I think that's pretty consistent as we'd thought. I think when we talked about it last week, we expected perhaps Scotland to do even better in home conditions, but the home conditions that we thought we were going to be watching, which was a pace-friendly wicket with a bit of colour and a bit of zip, was quite the opposite. Now, hearing from Kyle Kurtzer during the week, sort of made comment of the wicket and how much it was turning and it looked really dusty. He says, no, it's just the nature of the wicket and the grass up there. It just turns a little bit more than others. So he was quite cagey, wasn't he, last week, not to mention that this wicket they were going to be playing on, we'd end up seeing the home side just pick the one seamer in the majority of their matches, with Safian Sharif being partnered with four spinners. And we also saw the emergence of the Scottish Satna, didn't we?
Yeah, he's been fantastic. Taken, nine wickets in his first two international matches. Yeah, just with left arm orthodox. Just, it's a cheat code in international cricket, Tim.
Get him back in the team.
Exactly. Hamza Tahir, his name is, Scottish born, and made his ODI debut and took 4 for, and then backed it up with 5 for. Was it the next day or was it 2 days later? But either way, 2 ODIs for 9 wickets. Not the worst start to one's career. And I was saying a very Satna-esque action with that front arm. Yeah, that front arm doesn't really get up much, but I can just sort of watch him on the stream from the front. It'd be quite difficult to face where that arm comes over really quickly. So if you're trying to watch the position of the ball out of the hand, you've got to be watching very quickly. So, you know, good to see Scotland uncover some more local talent. So I guess it remains to be seen what squad they'll take to the UAE with all this spin quality that they've been able to execute at home. But with Ali Evans on the sideline, with Safian Sharif the only seamer, it's going to be interesting to see with what they go ahead with. I was watching a lot of the stream as we did. You know, some of those balls were turning square in Aberdeen. So I don't think we're expecting the same thing to be happening across Dubai and Abu Dhabi. So who knows what strategy Scotland will end up with.
Yeah, interesting. I don't know how deliberate it is, but a bit of a fake out almost to have it up in Aberdeen, where, you know, historically it rains a lot and you'd expect the pace bowlers to play a big part, and then have a raging turner up there. So full credit to the Scottish tacticians there. It's always nice to see a four spin attack, you know, harking back to the glory days of the Indian spin quartet, and I think it's a great sight to see. But good discovery of Tahir, as you mentioned there. But I think having all these guys going in, we've talked a bit about it before, just the depth that Scotland has, and they seem to be able to keep unearthing good talent, and that really speaks well of the development programs they've got going and puts them in good stead over the course of the, you know, next 2 and a bit years of this Cricket World Cup League 2. A bit of a mouthful to pronounce. And we saw it with Oman as well. You know, we all expected their pace contingent, Kalimullah, Fayez, but Bilal Khan, you know, all those guys to be playing a big part. And then, you know, we saw Bilal Khan sitting on the sidelines after a couple of games. And yeah, so I think it's been doing the job for them as well.
Just looking at Oman and the way they've been lining up, again, consistency does look to be a little bit of an issue, where sometimes when things go wrong, they just sort of collapse. In the match that Scotland did beat them, they lost by 85 runs chasing 223. And then looking at the game that they won, obviously they're only chasing a target of 169, I think it was. They did it so comfortably, only losing 2 wickets. They are a team that definitely shifts based on almost how they get up in the morning. You know, some days they're hot and other days they don't quite seem to be able to put it together. I just noticed with the lineup though that they are a little bit more consistent in who they've picked. Just before World Cricket League 2, we talked about how they had about 20 players in their rotation of squad members, and they were trying to find the team to move forward, and it looks like they're finally settled on a good 11. There was obviously questions of wicket keeping, and Suraj Kumar has been a really good addition as he provides with a bat as well. Sandeep Good's been a really good addition with both bat and ball. You talked about the pace attack, who have been effective, but maybe not so much here in Scotland with the wicket being a turner. And then they've brought back RJ Lalchetta again. He missed out in World Cricket League 2, but he's come back to play in this tournament. So it does look like they've got their sort of 11 locked up, ready to go for the rest of this tournament at least. Jatinder Singh and Kawa Ali opening the batting as well. So it does look like they've got themselves sorted, and they've put in a pretty good performance, you have to say, in tough Scottish conditions. I'm sure that the climate's not exactly something that they're used to. So I think it's quite encouraging for Oman to take a game off the hosts and end up with the same amount of points as a team like Scotland. And then, unfortunately, to look at PNG, look, we knew they were going to have their work cut out for them here, given how tricky it was for them to even finish fourth at World Cricket League 2 on that miraculous day in Windhoek that we'll never forget. And it's just showed, you know, PNG have so many guys in their team who do both. They bat and bowl quite effectively. They've just got to try and find the right balance to be able to perform at just that level above, because ultimately, you know, that's how they're going to be judged over the next 3 years, is these one-day internationals in cricket. World Cup League 2.
Yeah, you mentioned there, Bez, that, you know, PNG have a bunch of blokes who can sort of, yeah, do a bit of both. Yeah, it's sort of a little bit, they veer towards the bits and pieces, and that's not a criticism necessarily. You know, they've got a lot of guys who are just talented all-around cricketers, and they work hard on both disciplines. But yeah, you look at someone like a CJ Amini or a Chad Soper, or even Asad Vala, who, I mean, he's more of an all-rounder in that he's probably one of their best batsmen and a strong bowler, but their batting lineup floats around a lot. They've got a lot of guys who sort of can move up and down the order and bowl a few overs, and it seems like there's perhaps a lack of clarity over people's roles and, you know, who's exactly doing what. And when everyone can do everything, it perhaps leads to them being a bit muddled, and I think that's happening a little bit with PNG's lineup. And, you know, they've got Gaudy Toker, who's come in as a top order bat, and he's looked solid. But I think they need a couple more specialists and maybe one or two less all-rounders. That said, looking at someone like Alega Siaka, who should be a specialist batsman, and you look at him play and he's... I've taken to calling him the Papua New Guinean Carl Hooper, in that, you know, when you're watching him play, he looks a million bucks, and, you know, he can do anything with the bat, and then he just keeps getting out to lack of application. And we saw that in Namibia and against Scotland in their second game. You know, he took 6 runs and then 4 runs with a couple of boundaries, and then got out in the same over to Mark Watt. And he gets this thing where he digs in and he looks good, and then he maybe hits a couple of boundaries and then it goes to his head or something. And he's been doing this for years. You know, you think back to that century he made on ODI debut against Hong Kong, and everyone thought he was going to be the next big thing in associate batting. And he just hasn't really come along from there. And it's, I don't know if it's a mental thing, but it is frustrating to watch, because he's clearly got the talent, but just if he had the application, he'd be among the best in the world.
Just as you're talking about the depth and them needing to find some more specialists, I guess that brings to mind, you know, where you're normally looking and you're looking at your younger stock. But we can't forget that most of the under-19, well, most of the better under-19 players are banned for a year, aren't they?
Yes, they lost the whole crop to shoplifting. Yeah.
So they're going to struggle if they're looking at promoting from within and the youth as opposed from the A team, then that's going to have quite an effect. And all strength to PNG making that decision, knowing full well that it was going to put them in a weakened position. It was for the greater good. So it wasn't an ICC sanction. It was PNG putting that on their own players, that they would not be playing any cricket for a year and would go into rehabilitation programs.
Community counselling, yeah.
But yeah, it does put them in a bit of a spot, doesn't it? And coming out of this series as they have and really struggling early on, this is only 4 of 36 ODIs. And I guess unlike World Cricket League two and below, or even World Cricket League Championship, really, you know, if you lose a couple early, there's still enough time to get your way into the tournament. So hopefully they can get those positions sorted, just as you say. You know, as we're looking at the scorecard from their game against Oman, when Damien Ravu played, batted number 10 and didn't bowl, you know, that tells you that there's a team there that, well, either didn't read the conditions or they're not quite sure of their team makeup.
Yeah, perhaps they were hoodwinked by the conditions in Aberdeen being a little bit different. And to finally pick up on that point in regards to players coming through and the under-19s, of course, as you said, buried for a year. Gaudi Toker is one of very few players in PNG cricket over the last few years that has probably batted his way into the Papua New Guinea team. I think he was either player of the final or the player of the series in their recent Papua New Guinea T20 series. And the team that Papua New Guinea have put out internationally have been roughly the same 14 to 15 players over the last 3 to 5 years. So Gaudi Toker is one of few players who's actually been able to bat his way into the national team. And I think that's what makes a good national team, is having the competition underneath begging to be picked through fantastic performances, rather than guys who are coming into the side who haven't really proven themselves on a domestic level in a sort of sink or swim situation where they're basically thrown in it and told, yeah, okay, we need you to make runs now. And Toker has actually been quite handy at the top of the order for Papua New Guinea. It gives them another out-and-out batsman where, yeah, as we've mentioned several times before, the Papua New Guinea side are very versatile in that many can bowl and bat, but they don't have guys who are specialist bowlers and specialist batsmen, at least not on the whole anyway. Of course, there are a few exceptions. And the comparison from Siaka to Carl Hooper, if only Carl Hooper could run as fast between the wickets as Lega Siaka does. I don't think I've seen anyone in this level of the international game run faster between the wickets and in the field as Lega Siaka. He is lightning. He gets in and out so quickly.
That's true. He is rapid.
Yeah, I remember watching in Namibia just being amazed turning twos into threes on small grounds, especially at Afi's Park. And I remember sitting there and just looking at this guy just absolutely scamper between the wickets.
Just looking at Toker's numbers, the last major games he was playing for PNG was back 5 years ago when they were in the Under-19 World Cup. And it was funny enough, their last game of that, they went down to Pakistan and was Imam Al-Haq, who was a player of the match in that game. So it's interesting to always see the names that come through from the age ranks.
Yeah, well, that's when we were talking to Dennis Musali, who of course represented Uganda at under-19 level. He's always had a keen interest in watching international cricket purely because of all the guys that he played against at World Cups. And when the under-19 World Cup is a little bit bigger in numbers at 16, it's great viewing because, yeah, it gives these young guys a great opportunity to play against some highly regarded players around the world. If only the full senior men's and women's tournaments were just as big, but that's another podcast for another day, I suppose.
You know, we should do a podcast on that.
It's definitely not something that we've talked about nearly every week. And Carl Kurtzer gave us his thoughts from the week after his side went 3 wins from 4 against Papua New Guinea and Oman.
So pretty happy with the way things panned out in the end. 3 out of 4 wins, I guess, if someone said we'd have that at the start of the week, we probably would have taken it. I think the challenging thing for the Scotland boys were the fact that we haven't played any cricket for a little while, so that we just managed to get together 2 or 3 days before the first game. And obviously not that it's an excuse, but the news of the slam the night before the first game against Oman probably wasn't ideal preparation, but we've got very high standards of ourselves, so we expect that we should still be performing under those circumstances. Conditions were challenging, as you can see by the scores in all the games. I think the highest score by any side put on the board was 240, so you can see that the conditions are challenging, and the fact that one seam bowler was being picked in our side and all the rest were spinners was, you know, maybe a damning damning sort of sign that the ball was turning. So it was less than ideal, I guess, but they were even for both sides. But yeah, we're happy that we came out with the 3 wins out of 4. So yeah, all in all, a pretty solid week. A disappointing start, but a pretty solid week. And yeah, we're all in a pretty good place moving forward. overall throughout the tournament, throughout the R4 game, sorry, the standout performers, if you probably look at Hamza Tahir, the way he came in, conditions were suiting the spinners, but he came in and bowled with at a good pace and tried to spin the ball aggressively, and he sort of reaped the rewards of what was put in front of him. So outstanding performance by him, especially after, you know, his first game being his debut game, him getting four, and then him getting five in the next game against Oman. And the performance of Richie Berrington in the last game actually showed that if you apply yourself and play the right strokes and the right styles of shots, that you can score it more than a run a ball on that pitch. But it just took some getting used to and getting yourself in. So that was another highlight. But there were some steady performers throughout. Craig Wallace as well in the previous game against Oman played brilliantly with his 50, hitting the ball cleanly towards the end. And yeah, there were a number of other contributions along the way.
Well, boys, another chat in the books. Fantastic to speak with you once again. We're going to have to end today's show right there. Next week on the show, we'll run through the America's qualifying for the World T20, which is going on at the moment in Bermuda. We'll also look at the Namibia v Botswana bilateral T20 series being played in Windhoek, a place so close to our hearts, boys. And also, we'll look at Netherlands A taking on Jersey at the moment. But for now, to keep up with news from Cricket's New World, make sure to follow Emerging Cricket on your favourite social media platforms, and make sure to give us a 5-star rating wherever you are listening to the podcast. For now, for myself, Daniel Beswick, and the boys, Tim Cutler and Nick Skinner, enjoy the rest of your day wherever you are around the cricketing world.